Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese, and I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Daryl Mullendorf. Daryl is professor of international political theory and professor of philosophy at the Goethe University in Frankfurt. He's also distinguished visiting professor of philosophy at the University of Johannesburg. Now, Daryl works centrally in political philosophy, focusing centrally on issues of global justice, equality, responsibility, and human development. His new book has just been published with Oxford University Press. Its title is Mobilizing Hope: Climate Change and Global Poverty. To say the least, the news concerning climate change isn't good. The warming of our planet now threatens to trap millions of people in extreme poverty, while destabilizing the global order in ways that exacerbate existing global inequalities. Mitigation and adaptation strategies, even if adhered to, might not be sufficient. The situation, many think, is hopeless. But, as the title suggests, in Mobilizing Hope, Daryl Mullendorf argues that there's not only reason to hope that we might successfully address the climate crisis, but also reason to mobilize hope, that is, to act now in ways that can forge the kind of global solidarity that's necessary to meet the challenge. Now, as usual, there's a lot to talk about, and we will begin as we normally do, that is, with our guest. Hello, Daryl.
Hi, Bob.
How are you today?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Thanks so much for inviting me on to the show. I'm a big fan.
I appreciate that, and thank you for writing such an engaging book. Before we get to it, though, you know, we usually begin these episodes, as I suppose you realize, by me asking the author of the book to say something about him or herself. So can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Oh, let's see. Well, I grew up in Nebraska, and I grew up in, I was a young child during the 60s, and so I suppose something about that time must have influenced me. You know, there was a lot of social unrest. I remember the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated. And I think the 60s as a young child impressed me with issues of social justice that must have stuck with me. And by the time I got to high school, I had a couple of teachers that were quite influential, I think, in sort of setting me in a kind of an intellectual direction. I had one teacher who taught me a course on Greek and Roman civilization and encouraged me to read a book by Will Durant called The Story of Philosophy. And that was really good advice. I was really intrigued by the book. And I had another teacher who taught a course on the New Deal called Bosses and Workers. And I took an honors class from him in which he let me read Das Kapital. And that, of course, again, you know, I just thought, wow, this is what it, you know, reading stuff like this, this is what education's all about. And so I went off to college at a school that's a great book school, St. John's College, and I read a lot more sort of, you know, history of ideas, Western Western civilization, math, science, philosophy, all of that. And it left me wanting more, but I didn't really want to be a philosopher. I never conceived of the idea of being a philosopher. I had no idea of the professionalism of it all, and I had no idea what graduate school to apply to or any of that. I actually thought I was sort of more of an 11th thesis kind of guy. I wanted to change the world. But I thought I should learn more about philosophy before I do that. And so I went off to graduate school and thought I might get, you know, a master's of a public administration or business administration or something like that, and work for an NGO or a social justice organization. But along the way, take more philosophy classes. And I just liked the philosophy classes more than anything else I was doing. And then when I had the chance to teach philosophy as a graduate student, I thought, hey, you know, I'm enjoying standing up in front of these people and talking about this stuff. So maybe there's something to this. I didn't have a better plan. I didn't have it all worked out. And so I just kind of stuck with philosophy, and I've ended up, I wanted to be a continental philosopher. My ambition in life was to be a continental philosopher. And I wrote a dissertation on Hegel's philosophy of subjective spirit, which is all this sort of, it's the point in Hegel where what we would now call philosophy of mind occurs. All that sort of stuff occurs there. And writing the dissertation on, I went to Germany for a year, studied in Heidelberg. Writing the dissertation on Hegel just convinced me that I didn't want to be a Hegel scholar. And more or less that I'd really had enough of the continental philosophy that I had studied. It was good for me, but I was ready to move on. I was teaching courses at a community college on applied ethics. And I was reading these philosophers in the analytic, the Anglo-American tradition, talking very clearly about things like affirmative action and abortion and, you know, important issues, and making very clear arguments that you could kind of grasp and tract. And I thought, wow, this is, you know, for somebody who has concerns about the world in the way I do, this is really much more the kind of thing I want to be doing. And I kind of, you know, at that point, I changed directions and began to read a lot more in the Anglo-American tradition in moral and political philosophy. There was a period of 6.5 years in South Africa at the university that Witwatersrand right after the democratic elections. I was there from 96 to 2002. That was a tremendously exciting time. And then I came back to the States and eventually moved to Germany, where I am today.
Wow. The first graduate seminar I took was a Hegel seminar.
You survived?
I had a similar, maybe in some way similar reaction. I found part of the phenomenology deeply interesting and intriguing, and especially the early parts on skepticism and things. But then by the time I got to the end of it, I realized that there was no way to do this halfway. You kind of had to devote your, it was almost like Kant in that way. You had to devote your life to it, or, you know, sort of get what you were able to get out of it, and then, you know, find something else to do.
I think that's right. So life's calling, and you just have to decide if that's what's calling you.
Yeah. And there was a moment where I took seriously the thought, like, well, maybe I could do this. maybe I could dive in. And then, I thought, yeah, I don't know German. Anyway, so yeah. That's all very interesting. So let's talk about the book. Usually you sort of begin where the book begins. The first chapter argues that policymakers, and I should say that one of the nice and refreshing things about the book is how attuned you are at each stage of the argument to thinking about what philosophers, or maybe the particular philosopher that you are, should be saying to policymakers. So it argues that policymakers should indeed, against some criticisms that you address, should indeed limit or aim to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Now, you deal with two objections to this qua aim, the two objections to the idea that they should aim for this. You call them the uncertainty objection and the priority of global poverty eradication objection. Can you tell us a little bit about those, just to kick us off, tell us about those two objections and how you reply to them?
Sure, gladly. Maybe I should start, though, by just saying something briefly about that 1.5 degree warming limit, because it's come under a lot of discussion recently with the publication of the last Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report just a few weeks ago. And the origin of that warming limit goal, it appears in the Paris Agreement of 2015, but it's there as a result of pressure from civil society and also pressure from the small island states, who of course see climate change as an existential threat. And in the Paris Agreement, there's two numbers or two targets that are given. There's the two degree limit, which had been the sort of prior limit of aspiration, and then the 1.5 degree limit appears for the first time in that context. And I think I do think it's worth pointing out that it's not insignificant, the difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change produced a report a few years ago, a special report on 1.5 degrees. And surveying the literature, they found that the difference between limiting warming to 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees is the difference between trapping hundreds of millions of people in poverty for a generation or more. So it's a half a degree, but it's a very significant half a degree. So the objections that I look at in the book are one that the due to uncertainty with respect to how the climate system itself operates, and uncertainty about the relationship between CO2 and warming, we can't really take any target, any temperature target, as our policy goal. It's not that the problem isn't with 1.5 degrees. The problem would be the same problem if it were 2 degrees or 2.5 degrees. And the problem is that there's just quite a bit of uncertainty with respect to the degree with which a given amount of CO2 in the atmosphere will produce warming. And climate scientists refer to this technically as what they call climate sensitivity. And climate sensitivity is the amount of warming that would be produced by a doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere. And in this last report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they found that there's a range of uncertainty with respect to that, right? Going from 2.5 degrees to 4 degrees. What that means is if you think about CO2 in the atmosphere doubling over pre-industrial levels, so say that it's about 580 parts per million, that would be the doubling. What's uncertain is whether or not that would produce warming of 2.5 degrees or 4 degrees. And the best estimate that it's within that range is 3 degrees. But of course, that's a huge range. If you just think about the figure that I just recited to you, that, you know, the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees is hundreds of millions of people trapped in poverty. So there really is. I mean, there's no denying the uncertainty. But I don't think that gainsays the 1.5 degree target just for practical purposes. And the practical value of the 1.5 degree target is that it is something that people can well understand, and it's something that is probably the limit of what's feasible with respect to our policy today. And since it's going to be important to limit warming as much as we feasibly can, then the 1.5 degree limit represents a respecting the feasibility constraints and doing as much as we can with respect to that. That's the answer with respect to uncertainty. The priority of global poverty eradication objection is an objection that in spirit I have sympathy for. That the objection is, look, the most important thing to do is to ensure that people are pulled out of poverty, that their regimes have the capacity to engage in poverty eradicating human development. And in order to do that, we should set aside concerns about climate, and we should rather see to it that energy is provided as quickly as possible, energy that will provide for the kind of developments that will pull people out of poverty. And this energy, given what's available on the market, is going to be dirty. But because societies will be richer later on, then they can invest then in policies that will allow them to adapt to climate change, right? That's the sort of the essence of the claim. It's not a climate denial claim, and it's a claim that I think it's a concern that comes at least ostensibly from the right place, right? The concern about global poverty. But the basic problem is, as a position, it's just self-defeating. The problem is that climate change mitigation really is a pro-poor policy. The concern is that climate is going to trap people, climate change is going to trap people in poverty. And beyond a certain point of warming, it's just going to be impossible really to adapt to climate change. So it's no kind of response to the problem of poverty to say, deal with climate change second and deal with human development first.
Good. I have to say that that response to the priority kind of objection just struck me as pretty decisive. And I, again, as an interloper here, it seemed to me kind of intuitive.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think it. I mean, it seems all the more. It seems even more intuitive now, I think, probably than it did 10 or 15 years ago when it first appeared on the scene. And part of the reason for that is it's just so much more clear now that progress can be made in providing energy in ways that are not going to be significantly more costly, maybe even not more costly at all than by means of fossil fuels, because the progress in renewable technology has just been so enormous that the renewable energy is competitive in most markets with fossil fuel energy. So it's not so obvious that there are really any costs associated, except for dealing with the sunk costs of the already existing capacity. If there are any real significant costs associated with making the transition.
Great. So that's the part of the argument in favor of the aim, the sort of 1.5 aim that deals with two pretty common predominant sorts of objections. Now, for the positive side, though, of defending the aim, you invoke sort of two sort of central conceptual mechanisms for your argument, the anti-poverty principle and then the idea of hope makers. Can you tell us a little bit about each of those sort of crucial points in the positive case?
Yeah, sure, gladly. And you're right. I mean, the idea of the sort of the 1.5 degree limit is a conclusion that follows from an argument that invokes something that I call the anti-poverty principle. And the anti-poverty principle arises out of an interpretation that I offer of Article 2 of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change that states that the central objective of the treaty that is the Framework Convention is to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. And so the key term there is dangerous, right? I mean, there's already anthropogenic interference in the climate system, and it's already risky. And the question is what counts as dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. And I think what's important to see when trying to interpret this passage is that there's a difference between risky climate change and dangerous climate change. We oftentimes have reasons to assume risks. We think that there might be good reason to assume risky policies, but it's clear that in this passage that to call climate change or interference dangerous is to say that is to assume that there's a reason to avoid it. So that the idea of danger as it's used in this passage is normative. The proper interpretation of the passage has to be normative. So the question amounts to then, what kind of climate change do we have reason to avoid? And of course, this then in the international context forces us to think about what kinds of reasons that, you know, the international community, people around the world would have. And it becomes a sort of particularly difficult problem. You might think of it as a particularly difficult problem of public reason, right? What kind of reason could everybody around the world have to take climate change above a certain amount as dangerous or something to be avoided? And I think here progress can probably be made by thinking about involuntary poverty as something that everybody, no matter what their condition is, has reason to avoid the imposition of involuntary poverty or to avoid prolonging the involuntary poverty that they're already in. So the idea of the anti-poverty principle is to say that climate change that unnecessarily prolongs or imposes involuntary poverty is climate change that's dangerous. So the principle is, it's a normative principle, right? But it's an identificatory principle. The aim of the principle is to identify climate change that's dangerous. In order to do that, because danger is a normative concept, it itself has to be a normative principle. And then, connecting to what I said earlier about 1.5 degrees, since it's probably the case that 1.5 degrees is as ambitious as is feasible, then 1.5 degrees gets marked out as the point at which, or beyond which, climate change would be considered dangerous. That leads, of course, to the conclusion to take 1.5 degrees as the goal, and it's consistent with the aim of the treaty. The discussion at the end of the chapter on hope makers takes me into a part of the book. It's a theme that runs throughout the book, and it's the way in which I'm in the book profoundly influenced by Martin Luther King Jr. And I take the term from discussions that King has about the activists from the North who went down to the South to help integrate, and particularly to integrate coffee shops or luncheonettes. And King says that movement was a movement based upon the philosophy of hope. This is the way he puts it. And then at another point, in talking about the activists, the civil rights activists, he says that the civil rights activists themselves are America's hope. And in the philosophical literature on hope, in the moral psychology of hope, it's commonly understood that hope has two aspects. It has a normative aspect, that it has an intentional object that's taken to be good, and that hope, as an attitude at least, and that it also has an epistemic object, or it has an epistemic aspect, that it has an intentional object that's taken to be possible. And with respect to the latter, that the epistemic condition, that the object has to be taken to be possible, the strength of hope grows as the evidence of its possibility seems more compelling. And so a hope maker is simply a reason to believe that the intentional object is possible, something that gives credence to the possibility of the intentional object. And it can be, it can be a fact about the world. It can be evidence of the possibility of an event. It can be a theoretical explanation of the possibility of an event. It can be an interpretation of events that suggest that the outcome is possible. But crucially, it can also be, for you and I, it can be the actions of others, because so much of what we hope for might depend upon human action. And particularly, this is, of course, the case with climate change. When we see others taking action with respect to climate change, it can give us a reason to hope that a solution to climate change is possible. But it works for us as well. Our actions can be hope makers for others. And so that's the idea of mobilizing hope that's crucial to the book.
Right. So can I ask just a question maybe about how these two sort of central points in the argument might be connected? It struck me throughout the book that not only when you're talking about the anti-poverty principle, but when you're talking about poverty in general, it's often, the concern is often articulated as the concern not merely with poverty, although you're concerned with poverty, but it's the, as you were just saying, prolonged poverty, the being trapped in poverty, the circumstances that make poverty sort of an inevitable, durable, lasting condition for particular individuals, particular parts of the world. And I guess that as I was reading, it struck me as like, oh, okay, so the anti-poverty principle in part is a principle principle that's opposed to poverty as such. But it does also look like it has this sort of like the, and as you were just saying, the unnecessary, the unchosen, the, you know, the kind of poverty that, that somebody gets stuck in and there's no way out, which also looks like a sort of a kind of source of hopelessness. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, no, I had a sense you were going in that direction, and that's an interesting comment. And I say, honestly, it's a good comment of a reader of the book, because it's not something that the author of the book himself thought, which is very nice. It's very nice. It suggests that there's more there than I realize. But I like that. There is a sense in which that idea, the idea of the prolongation of poverty threatens a certain kind of hopelessness that is precisely what, we want to avoid.
Right, and hopelessness not only in the victims of that unnecessarily prolonged, condition that, you know, could be changed, but also from those of us who are the beneficiaries of a global order that permits that, there is a kind of, resignation that it suggests that is, I think, really unhelpful.
Yeah.
But
the idea of resignation, of course, is important here, because what's important about hope is that there is, it has this possible positive feedback effect, right? That if something is possible and we hope for it, then we're inclined to work towards it, and that can increase the possibility of the realization of it. But the nasty thing about resignation is that it can be self-fulfilling.
Right? That's right. That's right. William James has that discussion, and maybe you're not familiar with this, but about the strenuous mood. That's the important thing about hope, is that it has the psychological effect of, producing in us this sort of like go after it, get after it sort of set of attitudes.
Yeah. Right. Arguably, I think it's constitutive of hope that there's a readiness to pursue the object that one hopes for.
That seems right to me. Yeah. That seems right to me. Fabulous. Chapter two, and this picks up again on some of the things that we've already said. You make it, I think, a very nice, philosophically subtle but very important distinction between risk and uncertainty, as a way of proposing an argument for a kind of precaution. Tell us a little bit about that distinction and how it figures into the prescription about precautionary measures.
Yeah, there's a kind of a standard account of risk that takes it to be comprised of factors of the probability of a negative outcome and the magnitude of its disvalue. And so you estimate risk as a product of those two factors. And I mean, that works, of course, to the extent that you can give a value or a disvalue to the event, but for our purposes, more importantly, to the extent that you can estimate the probability of its occurrence. And much of climate change just doesn't work this way. Much of climate change involves uncertainties in the sense that it's impossible to attach a probability for any particular outcome. And these uncertainties I think of in two different ways. There are uncertainties that that exist in virtue of the outcome being at least in part the product of human action. And these uncertainties I call moral uncertainties. So for example, some of the impacts of climate change and how much we might need to adapt to climate change are uncertain precisely because it's not clear how much we will mitigate climate change. So these are uncertainties of this moral sort. But then there's a whole other class of uncertainties that I refer to as epistemic uncertainties. And these exist when our understanding of the events or the outcome just are insufficient to predict the likelihood. Sometimes they're just unprecedented or they're singular kinds of events. And I've already mentioned this with respect to the warming effects of CO2 in the atmosphere. There's just this range of uncertainty about how much a given amount of CO2 in the atmosphere will produce warming. And this just ramifies across the climate system. So it makes predictions of sea level rise, it adds to the uncertainty of predictions of sea level rise, and it adds to the uncertainty with respect to rapid ice sheet melting, methane and CO2 releasing from the tundra in the north, massive droughts, and so on. There's uncertainties across these range of effects, and that makes thinking about climate change or trying to plan with regard to various options regarding climate change something that can't simply be a matter of comparing risk factors. In one way or another, uncertainty has to be calculated into or be brought into the decision-making process. And I mean, some of these things that we're uncertain about are just frankly scary, right? Rapid ice sheet melting could just outstrip plans to protect or relocate communities around the world if it happens fast enough. Massive methane release from the tundra in the north would magnify warming severely and incredibly rapidly. Severe droughts could produce widespread hunger and put people in motion across borders, create all sorts of conflict. So I argue in that second chapter that our attitude towards outcomes like this has to be one of precaution, that we have to take a precautionary approach, that precaution is appropriate in light or in circumstances where we can't rely on risk to do the sort of the analytical work of helping us choose outcomes. But sometimes you hear people talk in the literature or sort of informally about the precautionary principle, as if there's sort of a single sort of understanding of what precaution is and what the principle is. And that's just a mistake. There are different kinds of precautionary principles, and they vary in at least two different ways. They can vary in terms of what they take to be the triggering conditions that would require precaution, what kinds of uncertainties, for example. And they disagree with respect to whether, in light of precaution, we are allowed to act, right? We have reason to act in that sense, or whether we're required to act. We have reason in that sense. And I argue in the book that in light of the sort of our understanding of the basic triggering conditions for possible catastrophe being in place, we don't know exactly what will tip, or what, you know, how much more warming will tip, but we know that the conditions are more or less in place, that in light of the triggering conditions for catastrophe being in place, that we have an obligation to try to limit warming as much as possible in order to prevent that. So the idea of the version of the precautionary principle that I defend in the chapter is to add reasons to the arguments based upon the anti-poverty principle for taking the lowest feasible temperature target seriously.
Great. So chapter three is, I think you say this in the introduction, is sort of the most philosophical in the sense of academic philosophy of them, because you get into questions about intergenerational justice, what we owe to people who don't yet exist or maybe no longer exist. So you defend in that chapter what you call the anti-catastrophe principle as the right account of what we, us here now, owe to future generations with respect to climate change. Can you tell us a little bit about, sort of maybe, I'm supposing many of our listeners will be familiar with some of the philosophical stuff here, without going too deeply into the weeds and the non-identity and all that stuff, but could you orient us a little bit to the general philosophical puzzle here, and then talk a little bit about your analysis?
Yeah, happily. I mean, I think you're right. It is the most theoretical chapter in a certain way. I suspect it's also in some ways probably the most disappointing chapter for philosophers, because I end on a very deflationary note. But right. It's the best I could do is my defense. So the idea is that a major concern about climate change is that that we have duties and obligations to future generations, and we should be very worried. Indeed, we are. We are very worried about what kind of world we're bequeathing to future generations. And I assume that that's a sentiment that is at this point fairly widely held. And so I don't think it's the case that the broad general public needs the philosopher to come in and convince them by means of an argument of intergenerational justice that we need to take this seriously. I assume that for many reasonably good-willed people and moderately educated people, they understand that this is a problem, and part of the reason why it's a problem is that we may be screwing things up very badly for people who will come after us. But what a theory of intergenerational justice tries to do is just to give an explanation of that moral sense, and it could possibly be useful also in circumstances in which there seem to be conflicts at stake. So I think that the right moral principle is going to have to be sensitive to the fact that our present energy policy, even the one that involves consuming fossil fuels, has been helpful. It's promoted human development, and in that regard, it could continue to be helpful. But of course, the help that it provides in the present redounds to the future. Right, people who are better off today have children who are better off. So there is, even in its helping in the present, there are positive intergenerational ripple effects. But of course, it's also very harmful. It's harmful both to people living now. We breathe polluted air. We have polluted groundwater, et cetera. And it's clearly harmful for people in the future. So it seems like some kind of distributive principle is what is called for in this context. A simple principle to do no harm or to promote well-being doesn't capture the sort of the complexities of the distributive case, I think. And so in the literature, in the policy literature, it's of course highly dominated by welfare economics, and the model there is something called discounted utilitarianism. The effort is the basic utilitarian one to maximize, and generally in this context what gets maximized is consumption. We can set aside that for a moment, but just the problem of utilitarianism, of course, is well known, that as an aggregating theory, it will allow for individuals or small groups of people to have to it will impose sacrifices on individuals or a small group of people merely for the benefit of benefits to a sufficiently larger group of people. And in the intergenerational context, since we're aggregating or maximizing across an infinite time horizon, very massive costs could be justified for very small benefits over an infinite time horizon. People who work with this theory understand this, and so they try to adopt a fix called the pure time preference. But then they can't figure out, there's no rational basis upon which to do. What's your preference? Well, my preference is X. My preference is Y. And there's just it just becomes a kind of taste, a kind of a taste test and nothing more. So that's a basic problem to the approach. Working with a German economist, Axel Schaffer, we tried to develop an alternative that was also a kind of a distributive approach. We called it intergenerational egalitarianism. And the point of intergenerational egalitarianism was to try to equalize the burdens of climate change across generations, where burdens were understood to be a function of costs against a sort of a level of well-being, that people with a higher level of being could bear more costs but have the same burden as people with a lower level of well-being carrying fewer costs. So it was a kind of intergenerational egalitarianism, which we thought could be a promising alternative to the discounted utilitarian picture, and you could also sort of nicely put it into their equations, which was Axel's job, not mine. I had no clue about it, but you could present it in a way to that audience that might be compelling. But it just turns out, for technical reasons that we don't have to get too far into it, that the weird thing about the theory is that if you're that what it demands, the kind of equality across generations that it demands, is actually impossible to achieve if you're successful with respect to climate change, because at some point the costs just stop and the generations, future generations, are wealthier. So it's just not, it sets aims that are impossible to achieve. So that can't possibly be the right theory. And
It's always nice to read a philosophy book where one of the things to be refuted is the author's former position.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we're supposed to do, right?
Yeah, that's right.
We follow the argument where it takes us, not necessarily where we want it to take us. And where it took me then in this chapter is to something that I call the anti-catastrophe principle. And the idea of the anti-catastrophe principle, and this is what's so, you know, so incredibly deflationary, is that what we should be seeking to do with respect to future generations is mitigating climate change to the extent that we can to prevent future catastrophes. And it fits, of course, nicely with the arguments that I made about the precautionary principle. And it also has the virtue of sort of aligning itself with the central objective of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to avoid dangerous climate change. And I sort of close to the end of the chapter, you know, in recognizing the deflationary character of the conclusion that I came up with, I quote Adorno, who once said that philosophy is the most serious of things, but then again, it's not all that serious. And the thought is, you know, in fact, it's not as if the world is waiting for philosophers to solve this problem. I think the world understands that we have an obligation to future generations, but it would be nice philosophically if we could provide an explanation of that, and it might even be useful in cases when there's conflicts with respect to what we have to do.
Can I ask I hope this doesn't push beyond the deflationary aspect of the principle, but can you say something, say a little bit more about, you know, what we're thinking about when we're thinking about catastrophe? We're thinking about a very, very bad thing that's going to affect very large numbers of people, or an extremely bad thing that might affect only smaller numbers of people, or a mildly bad thing that impacts the entire population of the world. Can you say something just a little bit about how you think about catastrophe?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think about these, I mean, in the literature on climate change, there's oftentimes this discussion of abrupt and irreversible events. And that's certainly a part of what's behind the idea of catastrophe, that there are this possibility of these events that are irreversible in the sense that there's no going back from them. They're going to fundamentally change the nature of the future. This could happen if, you know, with polar ice caps completely melt, there's no going back to the, and at least given the foreseeable technological horizon, there's no going back to a state in which we have polar ice caps again. But what's, I think, most important with respect to catastrophe are the kinds of climatic changes that we can't adapt to, that exceed our adaptive capacity. You know, if we can adapt to it, then it's one thing. And if we of course have the moral muster to adapt for it in a just way, then it's one thing. But I think of catastrophes primarily as those changes that exceed human adaptive capacity.
Fantastic. So chapter four takes up some questions about mitigation policies and particularly responsibility for enacting policies of that kind. And there you introduce a theme that's, you know, that comes up earlier in the book, but really comes to the forefront, the importance of solidarity. And there, you know, part of the argument there is that solidarity provides a particular kind of reason for action, which you call non-teleological. And chapter five then, you know, really brings solidarity to the foreground of the hope making stuff. So can you tell us a little bit about the responsibility for mitigation, and then lead us into the talk about the importance of solidarity?
Yeah, so I developed the notion of responsibility in concert with what I take to be the relevant principle of international justice in this context. So the principle of international justice comes from, again, from the United Nations Framework Treaty on Climate Change. There's a norm called the right to promote sustainable development that's stated in the document. And I give an interpretation and a defense of the norm as a liberty claim that medium and low income countries have to pursue poverty eradicating, energy intensive human development in a cooperative context of climate change mitigation. So, I mean, the history suggests that human development gains are very energy intensive, and so states who are involved in the cooperative effort of mitigating climate change are also low and medium income states who are involved in this cooperative effort are also intensely interested in being able to continue the process of poverty eradication to the extent that they've been engaged in it at all. I suppose I should say they want to protect their ability to do that. I argue that protecting their claim to be able their claim to have the liberty to be able to protect those kinds of activities is fully justified if we take seriously the morally mandatory project of poverty eradication, but we can also think of it the norm as justified as a matter of fairness in engaging in a cooperative project. If the reason why states would want to engage in the cooperative project of climate change mitigation is due to the threat of poverty traps, then the burden that's laid on them in the pursuit of the cooperative project shouldn't be one that undermines their aim of avoiding poverty traps. It shouldn't impose policies on them or requirements on them that would impoverish their population. And then a sort of more prosaic, but I think nonetheless important justification for the norm is simply that it's stated in the document. It's a promissory obligation that states who engage in, you know, that ascend to the treaty take on. And so the upshot is that highly human developed states it shouldn't be part of their business to make international proposals that would undermine the capacity for it. For low and medium income countries to pursue human development. On the contrary, they have to respect these aims of those countries. And that has, I think, then profound implications for a concept of, or for our understanding of responsibility. And here again, as in other points in the book, I draw on something that I learned from Martin Luther King Jr. In his famous I Have a Dream speech, he talks about America having a promissory note to African Americans, right. And what I think is nice about that way of putting it is that it allows us to see that a theory of justice is an account of the moral creditors. It's a theory that includes an account of who is owed what, and then by sort of by symmetry, an account of responsibility is an account of the moral debtors. It's an account of who has to pay in order that those who are owed get what they're owed. And so I think that we should then try to develop an account of responsibility that serves the account of justice. And the account of responsibility that I think that does the best job of that in this case is an ability to pay account of responsibility that holds states responsible for affecting the global energy transition on the basis of their capacity to do so, but where capacity means that they can do this without making major sacrifices to human development aims. And of course, this is clearly then the most highly human developed states who have the greater capacity, and they should take the lead in promoting the energy transition and assist low and medium income states in that transition to the extent that that's necessary for them to be assisted without, so that they don't damage their human development prospects. And so these are reasons of justice, right? They're reasons of responsibility and justice that highly human developed states have to mitigate climate change. And reasons of justice are based upon the claims of others. And reasons of prudence are based upon the claims of oneself. And I take there to be a third class of reasons, or maybe four or five for all I know, but there's a third class of reasons of solidarity that are based on the claims that we share with others. They're neither purely reasons of justice, the claims of others, they're neither purely claims of self, of prudence, but they're based upon the reasons that we have in common with others, or the reasons that we share with others. And they're especially also reasons that that require, as a matter of sort of a success condition, they require us to work with others in pursuit of the interests that we share with others. And these are particularly important when outcome requires collective action, and moral appeals might not necessarily be sufficient. And I think of reasons of solidarity as non-teleological reasons, because I think in the standard case, at least, they require agents to set aside their immediate interests in order to act for another interest that's shared with others. This can oftentimes be especially important to do, but it can also be costly to do. So in the classic strike situation of the 19th century, from which the solidarity gains its appeal, claims of solidarity were quite costly. I mean, there was a lot at stake involved in acting on solidarity, and there was a lot of danger with respect to doing so. But it helped, I think, and it helps as a motivating feature that one can also argue on the basis of solidarity that the person acting on the basis of solidarity will receive an outcome that that's indeed one that they intend, and that's of course a part of the difference between reasons of solidarity or an outcome that that from which they will benefit. That's part of the difference between a reason of solidarity and a reason of justice. And I mean, I think it's clear in the climate change mitigation case that that we have reasons of solidarity to mitigate climate change, and indeed to help medium and low income countries to achieve their mitigation aims. Climate change mitigation requires a net zero global economy, a close to gross zero global emissions will be required, and it has to happen everywhere, or it doesn't happen anywhere at all. And so, I mean, this is really sort of one of those cases in which an injury to one is an injury to all. That's I think clear to see. It's less obvious in the case of climate change adaptation, and this is because climate change adaptation typically involves taking measures that protect local communities or protect regions, and the success conditions then don't necessarily depend upon what's being done somewhere else in the world, or at least they don't obviously or directly depend upon what's being done in other parts of the world. So one might argue that that high income countries have reasons of justice to help adaptation in other parts of the world. But somebody might deny on the basis of this that there are reasons of solidarity to help with adaptation projects in other parts of the world. I think, though, on the contrary, that the argument can be made, and the argument can be made by appealing to what the consequences of adaptation failure are in other countries, and the way in which adaptation failures will invariably produce pressures in countries that may be more successful to adapting to climate change in forms that will be disruptive to their societies and disruptive to their politics. So there's a kind of indirect argument that can be made on behalf of the claim that there are reasons of solidarity as well as reasons of justice to support adaptation efforts in low and medium income countries.
Great. So, Daryl, you've been very generous with your time, and I want to make sure that we get to talk a little bit about the ending of the book, which, the book Mobilizing Hope ends with a call for hope with respect to, two particular sites, hope for the Paris Agreement, and secondly, hope for averting what you call the misanthropocene. can you tell us a little bit about those two sites for hope?
Sure. So in the context of climate change, one of the major hurdles that we confront is just the tremendous influence of the fossil fuel industry, both in domestic politics, but also in international negotiations. The influence that the fossil fuel industry has in slowing the process of climate change mitigation. They have assets in the form of fossil fuels that they won't be able to exploit if the temperature targets are to be met. These are assets on the order of $1 to $4 trillion. And so their interest, their business interest is to extend this process and to continue to be able to reap the profits of the assets as long as possible. And this allows them to spend lots of money on influencing politicians whose critical judgment is up for sale. And they also exercise influence even at the international negotiation. So that the next United Nations meeting of the parties, the Conference of the Parties, will be held in Dubai. And the head of that meeting will be the head of the Dubai National Oil Company. At the last meeting, there were more representatives of fossil fuel companies than of the 10 states who are most affected by climate change. So the influence is just pervasive. And countering this influence is, I think, the first political task, really, in trying to develop a response to climate change mitigation. And here, you know, I think the message of hope is particularly important, right? The message of hope is one that the future will be better, and that the future is it's possible. That making the transition to renewable energy will obviously produce a more stable climate. It will result in cleaner air, cleaner drinking water, more secure respect for indigenous control over lands, less international conflict, but also importantly, greater employment. There's very important studies that suggest that renewable energy is more job intensive than fossil fuel industries are. And so I think a message, it's possible to construct a message of the broad gains for a climate movement. And this really needs to be stressed, because what has to happen in order to counter the influence of the fossil fuel industry is a kind of mass mobilization. The idea is that the best way to counter the power of money is through the power of people in the streets. This brings me back to the message of Martin Luther King, who, of course, is well known as a theorist of nonviolence and as a theorist of civil disobedience. He's not as well appreciated as a theorist of mass movement building, but he was indeed that, and he was a practitioner, right? He led very successful mass movements, and part of the picture for King on and how to affect change against entrenched interests is this sort of persistence, right? That it won't be enough for there to be one demonstration this month and then maybe another 3 months, but 3 months from now. But there has to be this persistence of mass movement building, in which one event moves towards increasing the mobilization for the next, and so on. And so taking this sort of strategic attitude towards the building of mass movements, I think is essential. And I think this is where the message of hope is important, because it has the capacity to give people reasons to think that that change is possible. And the more we see people engaged in this kind of thing, the greater the capacity is that there can be a kind of contagion effect. So that's the short story with respect to climate change. But climate change is just one of the ways in which humans are fundamentally altering planetary processes. Biodiversity loss is hugely important as well. And these are putting pressure on planetary systems that are characteristic of what we now think of as the Anthropocene era. And if we fail to respond to the Anthropocene era effectively, it will mean massive human suffering, and it will mean profound ecological destruction. These are all, of course, all things that we have reasons to avoid, reasons of justice, reasons of self-interest, reasons of solidarity. But I think that there's something else that's important about this kind of a failure. It would be a massive failure of collective rationality for humanity, because it would mean that that we saw a better future, we understood that the future was better, and we failed to take the necessary means to achieve that better future. In this case, we failed to sort of rope in the destructive elements, the private interests that were against pursuit of the better future. But secondly, it would be an enormous failure of humanity to cooperate on reasonable terms to secure our interests, that we've driven by international competition and sectoral interests, we couldn't come to terms and cooperate to achieve this better world. So the Anthropocene, I think, implicates how we respond to the Anthropocene. I think implicates sort of fundamental human capacities, right? Human capacities for rational action and for reasonable action, for collective rational action and for cooperation on the basis of reasonable terms. So I mean, of course, it's enough in one sense that the Anthropocene could produce massive suffering and ecological destruction. But I think it's also important to see that there's a certain kind of there could be a certain kind of verdict on humanity that would be drawn on the basis of the failure. That the failure would suggest a kind of misanthropic conclusion, that it might have been better, as both Kant and Rawls with respect to different kinds of discussions suggest is possible, that if there's certain ways in which human beings could fail with respect to very important ends. In Kant, the case is the abolition of war, and for Rawls, the case is the failure to bring self-interest under control and to construct just regimes. There's certain ways in which humanity could fail that could call into question humanity itself, and this is why I think part of what's at stake is whether or not we're able to avoid the possibility of what I then call the misanthropocene. And again, this is where the idea of mobilizing hope, I think, is remarkably important, because it's through our efforts of talking to one another, of engaging with one another politically, that we can give each of us reasons to believe in the possibility that a better future is possible.
Well, on that note, Daryl, let's wrap up the discussion. I mean, thank you so much for joining me to talk about your new book on New Books in Philosophy. It's been really a wonderful conversation.
Bob, this has just been a tremendous opportunity for me. I can't thank you enough for you giving me the opportunity.
Well, I really enjoyed the book. And, you know, to those who are listening to us, you know, it's a really fascinating, engaging, accessibly written book. And I recommend it highly. Listeners, thanks once more for joining New Books in Philosophy for the discussion. I've been talking to Daryl Mohlendorf. He's written a fascinating book called Mobilizing Hope, Climate Change and Global Poverty. It's newly published by Oxford University Press. So once again, thank you for listening to New Books in Philosophy, and bye for now.